I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Jonathan Richards. He's an actor, writer, artist, multi-talented person, and he's co-author, along with Tad Richards, of Nick and Jake, an epistolary novel. And he will be in conversation with Valerie Plame on Thursday, September 20th at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. Welcome.
Well, thank you. Nice to be here.
So this is a novel basically written in the form of letters among various people, not just two people, but all kinds of characters.
Right.
And you and your brother conceived of this and wrote it together?
We wrote it together. It seemed the epistolary format, which is not much in use, but is a nice old hallowed literary tradition, seemed good because he's in Woodstock, New York, and I'm here. And we decided that we could write this letter, write this book in the form of emails back and forth to each other. And it began with an idea that he had of just speculating. I think he teaches writing in a college in New York State. And he had, I think, suggested at one point to his class that it would be interesting to speculate on what Nick Carraway from The Great Gatsby and Jake Barnes from The Sun Also Rises would be like if they were to meet in Paris maybe 25 years after their moment in the sun. And from that we extrapolated a fairly crazy and sometimes funny and sometimes cautionary story of the political and international politics world of 1953.
So 1953, we're talking the McCarthy era, and indeed Senator Joseph McCarthy plays a major role in this novel. What was it about McCarthy and the McCarthy era that drew the two of you? I mean, is it something that is important to you that you have memories of, anything like that?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. We were teenagers during the McCarthy era, and we lived in Woodstock, New York, and a lot of our friends, a lot of our parents' friends, were people on the left side of the spectrum, and some of them had trouble with the McCarthy and HUAC and that sort of thing. So it was all it was something that was talked about and something we were aware of. We were too young to really be involved in it, but we knew that people we liked, friends of ours, intelligent, good, decent people, were having trouble because of the political climate of the time, McCarthy and HUAC and all of that.
One of the things that I think is rich material for a novel like this is not only was it a kind of dark time in American history, but there was so much political intrigue and spying and betrayal of people who, I mean, as a reader, you think you know them and then they do something else that surprises you. In real life, there must have been horrible betrayals among people who also thought they knew each other.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, the most, probably one of the most celebrated cases is Elia Kazan, who famously named names and then made an awfully good movie in defense of it, On the Waterfront, which is basically a brilliant, brilliant movie, which makes the case for naming names and lining up with the establishment bringing the bad guys to justice. The bad guys, in his case, were waterfront thugs, but what he was really talking about was communists.
Right. And there's also all the spying that went on and all the really interfering in other people's and other countries' ability to live their lives and do the things that they were doing. And again, when you're writing this, I mean, you presumably, having lived your life as an artist and writer and everything, an actor and everything, haven't had firsthand experience in spying and interfering in other people's lives. So how do you do the research to get that kind of stuff more or less accurate?
Well, there's this thing called the internet.
Yes, I've heard of it.
Which makes all sorts of research a lot easier. When I started writing novels back in the 70s, You did your research by going down to the reading room at the 42nd Street Public Library and ordering 5 books at a time and sitting there at a table and taking notes. And now you just sit at your desk and do it with the push of a button, and it makes research a lot easier, and it also makes the kind of things you find perhaps more wide-ranging, because when you're in the old school of research, when you were ordering the books from the stacks at the library, you were pretty much constrained to what you could get, what you could think of, what you found in the card catalog, and then what you found in those books. Now you'll find something, and that'll trigger a look at something else, and then you'll go click on something else, and all of a sudden you have areas of information coming in that you would not have even thought of asking for. But in terms of, the spying or the international skullduggery that was taking place in that year of 1953, that was the beginning of the Eisenhower administration and the beginning of the CIA. CIA had taken the place of the wartime OSS, so a lot of the same people involved. And this was really the first year that the United States tried its hand at the skullduggery of nation-building and overthrowing foreign governments. And the foreign government, there were two. There was the government of Jacob Ardens in South America, and then there was Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran, where the Shah was our guy, but the people liked and elected overwhelmingly and overwhelmingly approved of Mohammad Mossadegh. But the British and the Americans, it was really more the British who had the oar in that water. They were having all of their oil wells nationalized by the Iranian government, and they wanted Mossadegh out of there, and they enlisted the help of our government. And we arranged for massive demonstrations in the streets against Mossadegh, and eventually got him thrown out and brought the Shah back in, and we all know how well that turned out.
And Mossadegh comes across as a very sympathetic and wonderful character in your book, although he's described indirectly by other characters in the novel, but it's just another example in American history of how democracy just plays no role whatsoever in United States policy. And so, for example, Mossadegh says, Britain says, well, you can't nationalize your oil companies. And Mossadegh says, well, we got the idea from you, Britain, that nationalized your railroads. He says, well, we're a civilized country. He says, well, we were civilized millennia before you.
Right, when your ancestors, Winston Churchill's ancestors, were wearing bearskins. I think there has been, believe me, at this time when we've just had the Democratic and Republican conventions and we're all sort of in a froth of democracy, it is not by any means our intention to attack the American system or the system of democracy. There's a great deal of good that is done by it and in its name, but there are some dark sides too, and it's the dark sides that we're looking at here. But I don't want to emphasize darkness too much, because the fact is this is a very funny novel. It's not intended to be something that you're going to go home and slash your wrists after reading. It's a satire, and we have a lot of fun by combining historical characters with characters from fiction and just letting them interrelate. It's a wonderfully liberating thing to do with characters.
So these two, Nick and Jake, Nick Carraway and Jacob Barnes, are characters that it must have really been fun to figure out, first of all, what they would be like having aged and become sort of middle-aged dudes.
Yes, and a lot of their characters are drawn from the characters of their creators. There's a lot of Hemingway-esque stuff in Jake Barnes, and there's a lot of Fitzgerald mannerisms and insecurities in Nick Carraway. But yeah, they also have dealings with Larry Darrell, who is the Razor's Edge, the central character of the Razor's Edge, and there's Alden Pyle, who is the Quiet American in The Quiet American by Graham Greene, Thomas Fowler, the British journalist. And so all of these people interact with real-life characters like Christine Jorgensen, the sex change pioneer, and Roy Cohn, who was the lawyer for McCarthy's committee and then later went on to a certain amount of fame in Angels of America,
Angels of America
by the end of his life.
Looking absolutely horrible as a human being in that movie.
Yes, yes. I think there was something of that to him. I interviewed him once for a magazine.
Really?
Yeah. He was, but I think one of the two things I remember very well about Roy Cohn, he had a penthouse office, a sort of a glass enclosed room on the top of a brownstone in the East 70s. And he was the tannest person I ever met. He made George Hamilton look pale. I interviewed him, and what I knew about Roy Cohn at the time basically was that he was the prosecutor in the Rosenberg case and that he was the right-hand man of Joe McCarthy. So that was what I was talking about in the interview. And finally, at one point, he stopped and said, "Look here, young man." He said, "I thought I had an agreement with your editors that this interview would not just be about McCarthy, you know, that there would be more wide-ranging." And I didn't know what else to ask him. So I said, Well, sure, Mr. Cohn, what would you like to talk about?" And he then said, "Well, I have a lot of fun." He said, "I've got a lot of friends, lots and lots of friends. I've got, you know, my friends and I will get together and we'll rent a private jet and we'll fly down to New Orleans for the Super Bowl. All my friends, and I thought I had never heard anybody use the word friends so often in one paragraph, and I thought, this is a man who doesn't have a friend in the world.
I know, I was going to say, methinks the gentleman doth protest too much.
Yeah. I think he was a little, I think he knew a lot of people, but I think that maybe he wasn't so sure about how they felt about him. He also took me down to his bedroom, he was showing me the townhouse, and he made, I will say up front, no improper advances, but he did show me around his bedroom, and I can tell you a little known fact that Roy Cohn was proud of having the largest collection of animal bands in the country, or perhaps in the world.
Of what?
Animal bands, little ceramic figurines of squirrels playing the violin and badgers playing the drums, and there were little collections of animal musicians, ceramic animal musicians, and they lined a rather large room and shelves all the way around. He had the world's largest collection. The other thing he had that I thought was perhaps more meaningful for the bedroom was they had the nose cone of an ICBM, which I thought said something about at least what he aspired to.
Roy Cohn's nose cone.
And in this novel, we have Roy Cohn, who is an historical character. We have cast him as the nephew of Robert Cohn, who is the writer who has the affair with Brett Ashley, and then loses her to the bullfighter in The Sun Also Rises.
Ah, so one is a fictional character and one is a real, and
that's
just
right.
Made them related.
We are blurring those lines.
Well, you also made Alden Pyle the son of Nick Carraway.
Nick Carraway. We had to change some names there. We had him as Alden Pyle Carraway, but he was ashamed of his father being a Republican functionary, so he drops the last name and goes by Alden Pyle. Yes, it's right. The great thing about writing fiction is you can do really pretty much anything you want to. It has to work, but you don't let the fact that it's not true stop you, because after all, it's fiction.
We're talking to Jonathan Richards, co-author of the novel Nick and Jake. So getting back to something you said a moment ago, you made Nick Carraway, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, and the Jake character, something like Hemingway. Do you think that those were autobiographical characters in the first place?
I think all things like that. I think first-person novels almost inevitably have something of that to them. I think that there are probably they're almost certainly elements of those two writers' characters. And then we used some, extrapolations of things, of incidents that, for instance, I think it's in A Movable Feast, but Hemingway writes about an incident where he said that Fitzgerald was always insecure about the size of his male member, and that one time they were in the men's room together, and he had to reassure, Fitzgerald asked him if he thought it was normal, and Hemingway kind of looked at it and said, "It's absolutely fine, and it's just Zelda.
Oh boy.
Zelda's playing head games with you." So
this is, because this is a theme that goes throughout this book.
This is a theme that repeats, and there is a section where we've extrapolated that scene into a different setting, but that is from Fitzgerald and Hemingway, and there are other things like that too, but. We imagined Jake as a very self-assured, well-settled journalist, expert in London, in Paris, and Nick Carraway as a bit more diffident, as a bit, he's done a number of different things in his life, and Nick Carraway runs afoul of the McCarthy Committee, through really no fault of his own. He's a good Republican and never had a treasonous thought in his life, but that did happen to people with exactly those credentials in those days. So he ends up going to Paris and becoming friends with Jake Barnes, and then together they find themselves involved in the various other things that happen in the book.
And without giving really anything away, Nick actually does change through the course of the novel.
Yes, he does. Yeah, one always tries to see if one can make a character develop, and I think in his case, Jake undergoes a quite remarkable change at the end of the book, but we'll leave that to the reader to discover.
Yes, indeed. Now, does this form, the epistolary novel, so you've got all sorts of people writing letters to each other, and indeed you and your brother wrote this novel via email back and forth across the United States of America. Does this form, do you think, come easier to you because you're an actor and it's a bit more like dialogue than straight-up novelistic narrative?
Straight-up novelistic narrative offers the advantage of being able to use actual dialogue, exchanges of lines, which doesn't really happen in an epistolary novel. You've got to write... There's no narrative in an epistolary novel. The narrative, the story, is all unfolded by the exchanges of letters. And in this case, some news articles, some cables, that sort of thing.
Which is also true of playwriting. There's no narrative in that either.
That's right, but that's all dialogue, and it's... I say, old chap, where are you going? I have an appointment with your wife. I mean, whereas in this, some of the letters go on for a couple of pages, and a number of them are very short too. So it does have the effect of dialogue. You're exactly right in a lot of places, but I would say that probably a dialogue-heavy narrative novel gives the more of the effect of a theater piece.
Interesting. Now, who are the literary models for epistolary novels?
Oh, golly. I've read a few, and I don't really know what the classic ones are. So that's nothing I can really talk to. Certainly the epistolary form, the great letter writer of literature is Madame de Sévigné, but that's not that's just letters in which one learns a great deal just by what she's writing, but I've read a few. One that comes to mind, a little remembered novel from the late 60s, early 70s, was The Man Who Wrote Dirty Books, and that was something which was done entirely in an epistolary format. There are plenty of others, but I don't have them cataloged.
Right. Now, I just wondered if any of them had been particularly inspiring to you.
No, not really. We really pretty much, felt our way through this. And we were very fortunate to, after a very long and arduous experience, and I'm sure any of your listeners who are trying, who have written or are trying to write books and try to sell them, are aware of the fact that it is not nearly as easy to sell a book in this time than it was, let's say, 20, 30, 40 years ago. You could make a decent living as a mid-list writer in the 70s and 80s. That's pretty much gone. And
yeah.
So to find a publisher, we had in fact self-published a small edition of this novel. We hadn't really given up.
Which we talked about when it first came out. And it's so delightful to see it in hardback by a real publisher with
exactly.
a nice cover.
It feels like, I don't know, that we've gotten out of jail or something. But now we have a publisher for whom a publicist is at work, and so we've actually gotten a very amusing little gig to do is to promote the book on the Huffington Post. They have a sort of literary corner, literary blog section, in which people contribute things like one that we looked at and sort of got the idea of what they were looking for is somebody who has written about the great cocktails of literature, you know, talking about the martinis and the sun also rises and the cocktails from James Bond and from various different amusingly done. So they have asked us to come up with, since Nick and Jake are characters from disparate literary sources who we have brought together, they've asked us to speculate in a sort of short satirical paragraphs on other literary characters who we could bring together and describe a little bit of what their story might be like. So Tab and I got that assignment and we've been working on it. And we have we've thought of pairings like Beowulf and Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter.
Oh dear.
We've got Nero Wolf and Hannibal Lecter, two gourmand, gourmet intellectuals with slightly different ethical bents. We've got the two guys from the Wedding Crashers and The Ancient Mariner. If we recall, The Ancient Mariner stops the young man on his way to the wedding and talks his ear off for a few hours, and he misses the entire wedding. So, one that I like, the title is Tell Me About Rabbit, George. And it's Lenny and George from Of Mice and Men, who, after killing the girl inadvertently, breaking her neck by mistake, they flee to Pennsylvania, where they meet Harry Rabbit Angstrom, the John Updike character, and become great friends until, in an impromptu pickup basketball game of one-on-one, Lenny inadvertently breaks Rabbit's neck.
Oh, dear.
So there are things like that.
Right.
I think
it sounds like fun anyway.
It is fun. It's the sort of thing that you can just go on endlessly with.
Now, you are an artist and you do all these wonderful cartoons. Are we going to see a rendering of the middle-aged Nick and Jake?
Well, there was a rendering of the middle-aged Nick and Jake on the cover of the self-published edition, which we did through Lulu. I did, and I actually based the character of the middle-aged Nick on my father, on Tad's and my father, and but the publishers, the real-life publishers, the legitimate people at Skyhorse and Arcade, which is the Skyhorse imprint that has put this out, felt, and I think rightly so, that cartoon covers don't sell books.
Right.
And except for possibly cartoon books. And they have designed an absolutely smashing, spectacular cover for this book. It's a sort of a pop art typewriter, old Remington typewriter with a sunburst behind it.
Yeah, it's
which
great.
Which is just really eye-catching. I love it.
And the typeface throughout the book is also varied depending on what the medium is, whether it's diplomatic cables,
right,
or typewriter face, or an article in the Herald Tribune.
Right, and then some of them are even hand-scrawled, which we had to hand-scrawl ourselves and try to... We got a
That's
few
right.
friends, roped a few friends in to get different handwritings, and
Now, I have to ask you, in terms of Nick and Jake, here you are, you and your brother writing this novel together, Jonathan and Tad Richards. What, did one of you always write Nick and the other one always write Jake?
No, we started, that was our idea to start with. I thought that I would write Nick and Tad would write Jake. But actually, I wrote the first two or three letters. I mean, I just sort of got going on it, and I had an idea for what the response to the first letter was going to be, which comes from a dear friend of mine who many years ago, who lives in Santa Fe now, and many years ago he had a theater in which he had the idea that he wanted to put on a marathon of Samuel Beckett plays, a 24 hours of Samuel Beckett, but he didn't have enough material to fill 24 hours. So he wrote to Samuel Beckett and said, "Dear Mr. Beckett, here's my idea. I want to do 24 hours of Beckett. I need a few more plays. If you have anything lying around or would care to write something for me, I would be delighted, and we could then fulfill this this schedule." And he received a reply from Samuel Beckett with one sentence, who said, "Dear Mr. Flicker, I would sooner swim the Marne. Yours truly, Samuel Beckett." So that becomes Jake Barnes' reply to the first letter he receives from Nick Carraway. I just always thought it was such a classically simple statement of refusal.
That's so great. Now, one of the characters in your book is talking to another one who's writing fiction, and he says, you have to have a love-hate relationship with your characters. Is that true for you?
I think it's true, I think you tend to have more of a love relationship with your characters, but there's got to be a bit of an edge there. And the thing that any writer of fiction will tell you, I think, or at least the ones that I've talked to confirm this, that you often start off with a character who you have conceived in a certain way, and as you write that character, he slips through your fingers and becomes somebody else.
Right.
One of the first novels, I guess the first novel I wrote, was a novel called Cherokee Bill, which also involved historical characters. And one of them was Judge Parker, the hanging judge of Fort Smith, Arkansas. And we had absolutely no use for this guy when I started writing the book. He just seemed like a total villain, and he was a villain. But as you write him, you can't write him and humanize him at all without coming to sympathize to some extent with the human character you're creating. So he never became a sympathetic character, but he became certainly more sympathetic than I ever thought he was going to be.
The book is called Nick and Jake, an epistolary novel by Jonathan Richards and his brother Tad Richards. And Jonathan will be in conversation with Valerie Plame on Thursday, this Thursday, the 20th of September at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore, where you can pick up a copy of the book and listen to them talk about it.
Hear all about it.
And yeah. Hear even more about it. Jonathan, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It's always a great pleasure, Mary Charlotte.
And today we are talking about the organization Children First, and we are joined by Sarah Bennett, who is the president of the board of that organization, Kathleen O'Wegan, who is a board member, and she's a mediator who conducts the co-parenting classes, and Ellen Biederman, also a board member, who works with the Safe Haven program. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Children First, what's it all about? Let me guess. Children.
Children. Our goal is to help children whose parents are going through periods of separation or divorce, or perhaps never married, learn how to co-parent effectively, and that means sharing decision-making when they share custody. So learning how to work together to make decisions, to move forward in a peaceful way and allow their children to have a happy life.
And so what kind of problems come up during a divorce? I suppose, to some extent, they probably reflect problems that were already there during the marriage.
I have always thought that some parents would benefit, even in intact families, from the co-parenting workshops that we conduct at Children First, because what parents learn is how to communicate in an appropriate way to make decisions together. Some of those problems perhaps existed in the marriage. It's more difficult when you live in different houses. And children don't come, they don't come with an instruction manual, but certainly There is no instruction manual on how to co-parent until you arrive at a recognition that you don't have those skills and you need to go to Children First to learn them.
So, Kathleen, you actually conduct these co-parenting classes. What is the need and what do you teach?
Well, we actually, there's a whole team of facilitators who conduct the co-parenting classes. I'm just one of them. And all of our facilitators are mediators and therapists, people who are familiar with families and co-parenting dynamics. And what we do is we have a program for people who are high conflict, and we have a program for people who are low or moderate conflict. And as Sarah was mentioning, we teach them how to reframe their perspective of the other parent from whatever name they might think of them as that might begin with a B or some other letter, that they think of them as their co-parent instead of the ex or whatever. And so right away we're teaching them to reframe the way they see the relationship as a team, as a new kind of conscious partnership different from the partnership that they're leaving in their relationship.
Right.
And so we teach them how to reframe their perspective of their new relationship and of their co-parent. Then we teach them communication skills, which include things that many people have been exposed to elsewhere and many have not. Things like iMessages, active listening, negotiation skills, and so that our goal is that by the time they finish our classes, they see one another as a team in support of the well-being of their child, and they've put away whatever issues they were carrying that came from the old relationship, and that they are able to negotiate changes in their parenting plan when they need to, decisions that need to be made about their children's future, and that their children then do not feel the trauma of parental conflict, because statistics show that divorce is not the traumatizer for children. It is conflict. Children can adapt to any change in their lifestyle with a strong co-parenting team supporting them.
Yeah.
It's when the parents are in conflict and insulting and denigrating each other in front of the children that the children become then traumatized.
Well, divorce is also a trauma.
It can be. But so many people will stay in a conflicted relationship just to avoid the big D, the big divorce, or the big separation, when in fact that exposure to that conflict is traumatizing to the children. And regarding your comment to Sarah earlier, in fact we have many of our co-parenting teams who said if they had had these tools before their relationship went south, they may never have had to transition their relationship in the way that they did through divorce and separation.
Right.
Yes, and so you're absolutely right. If people had those skills ahead of time, it would make so much difference.
Yeah, that'd be another another nonprofit or another wing of
absolutely.
Of this. Yeah, because like you said, you don't have to get a license to get married or to have kids, or you don't have to take classes, and some people probably need it.
Well, what happens is that when people go into a romantic relationship, there's no forethought, there's no consciousness, there's no agreements and clarification of expectations, and so sometimes those relationships don't work out, and so we're inviting them into a new relationship that's a conscious one, where they have skills and they have the ability to work together regardless of what structure they're in.
Do you find that certain problems that couples come in with, because you've been watching this for quite a long time, make it really harder? For example, betrayal or money conflicts or things like that, when they bring that in, it makes it harder for the kids?
Absolutely. And what happens is that there's so much pain and anger around those kinds of situations that the parents end up spewing that at the other parent in front of the children, which causes the children to feel traumatized. And so what we teach them is ways to put that somewhere else, not in front of the children, and to focus not on what happened in the past, but how do we co-create a future that is peaceful and focused on the well-being of our children rather than focused on punishment and retaliation for whatever didn't work in the relationship.
Which are probably good skills for the workplace and for making the world a better place and that kind of stuff too.
Absolutely. These are many of the same skills that we teach in, that mediators learn to use, and that we teach in all kinds of conflict resolution arenas. And Children First has just taken this one step further and taken the tools and adapted them for a co-parenting situation.
Now, where are the kids when you're doing this work with the parents?
Well, they're with some other caregiver. The parents are not in the same group together, so very often the children are just with the parent who's not in class at that time. We ideally have the parents going through concurrent classes, but on different nights of the week. And almost never are the parents in the same group together, so that they have an opportunity to not feel uncomfortable and restricted by the presence of the other parent. Many times we have what we call bonus parents in the group, and a bonus parent is what common society would call a step parent. But that new person, we invite them, we encourage them to come to the co-parenting classes too, because they often, advertently or inadvertently, are a contributor to the conflict dynamic. So if we can teach them additional skills in communication and negotiation, it just creates a larger, more supportive team for the children.
I would think that one of the things you have to be very careful of, or that parents should be very careful of, is not bad-mouthing the other parent.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that we emphasize a lot in class, is that psychological studies show that children self-identify as part mommy and part daddy. So if mommy's a witch and daddy's a loser, then what am I?
Right.
And so part of what we teach them is to not put down the parent in front of the children, not to the other parent, not to their friends. Whatever ventilating of that nature they need to do, they should do it in a safe and private environment with a counselor or a friend or someplace out of earshot of the children.
Now, the groups are not gender segregated.
That's correct. We have both men and women in every group. But we rarely have the same co-parenting team in the same group. Our facilitators, we always have two, and we always have a man and a woman, so that they're reflecting the group themselves. And we must all have been through a difficult divorce ourselves, either as a divorcing parent or as a child of a difficult divorce, so that none of our facilitators are coming from a place that is estranged or different from what our participants have experienced at some level.
Do people like you, who are mediators, tend to come from conflicted families and conflicted situations? I mean, is that what drives you into the profession?
I don't know. They often say that mediators are almost always middle children. So somehow we're in the middle of a family and we start negotiating, you know, from the time we're wee little ones. But I don't know if that really, how much that plays out. For me, my personal incentive is that I'm one who wants to restore harmony to the planet, and disharmony happens one to two people at a time. So rather than work on a planetary level, I work on an individual level. And so for me, it's all about restoring harmony, and it's all about making the world a better place for the babies. And so working with Children First lets me do both at the same time.
We're talking about Children First with Kathleen O'Egan and Sarah Bennett and Ellen Biederman. Now, Ellen, you do the Safe Haven program. What's that?
That's another component of Children First. And for parents who haven't successfully gone through the co-parenting plan or can't seem to figure it out, but the court has ordered visitation or even joint custody, but the parents are in so much conflict that they can't even see each other to exchange the children, Safe Haven provides a safe way that they can do that without putting the child in the middle of a conflict situation. So parents, because the person who has the child will come and go to one place, and then the other parent will come 15 minutes later, and a Safe Haven volunteer will actually physically transfer the child from one parent to the other.
And so the parents don't have to see each other.
They don't see each other at all. They come at different times and they leave at different times. And there's a volunteer with each parent at all times.
Oh, okay. And so for 15 minutes, the kids get to play in the Safe Haven or hang out.
They play in the space that we've set up. It's done in churches, actually. And it's done right now at Temple Beth Shalom and at the Unitarian Church. And we have toys for the kids. And, you know, sometimes the parents are doing last-minute instructions for them, or the kids are... It depends on the age of the kid. Because the kids, we've exchanged kids as young as 6 weeks, and then there's teenagers. The parents still can't figure out how to let the teenager even, like, walk to the other parent's house or do it after school. So we provide a place for them. to do that. It's the children end up feeling very comfortable and going back and forth once they get used to it, so it does provide that, quote, safe place for it to happen.
You know, some of those exchanges between parents before Children First were done at the McDonald's parking lot or at a police station.
Right.
Just to have a public witness to avoid the conflict. So it's so much more friendly for a child to be in a calm, you know, the faith, well, Temple Beth Shalom and Unitarian Church are lovely, calm places. And so it
yeah, which is what they're supposed to be about in the first place.
Right, exactly. So it seems that it contributes to everybody's well-being to have it there.
The other thing that's been interesting is we've had several families where it's actually been a grandparent that's been trying to get visitation rights. And we've done the exchange because the grandparent is in conflict either with their daughter or son or their daughter or son-in-law, and we've done the exchange so the grandparent can have visitation rights, which has been really interesting dynamics going on. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of variations of who actually does it, but the emphasis again is making the child has a smooth transition as possible.
Now, do you see in this work people actually changing, calming down, and really becoming better co-parents?
You know, I come to it as a lawyer. I do divorce law, and I have had many of my clients go to the workshops and report to me what a wonderful message they received, and they were so grateful for the skills, and they were glad to be able to bring back to their relationship the ability to communicate in a better way, and some of them have actually reported that their life has changed, even if the other co-parent hasn't taken the course. It allows them to process those pieces of information in a different way and monitor their own behavior better. It's a wonderful contribution. I think for the courts, of course, we provide a lot of support for the courts. Many of these cases are in frequent litigation in the courts, and there's disputes over custody. The courts refer us a great majority of our clientele. Mm-hmm. And so there are a lot of, you know, implications for our society as a whole, the courts, the burden on the courts, and all of those kinds of things that we're addressing by helping people in the way that Kat just described.
Mm-hmm. And I would just like to add that we have seen profound shifts in many, many people. We have a very high success rate of some degree of shift, positive shift in the relationship. And in our 13-week class, which is the higher conflict group, that usually by about week 5, people are starting to see possibilities and maybe starting to see the co-parent in a little bit different light, and they're willing at that point, which is about when we start giving them the communication tools, they're willing to actually try them. And sometimes they won't try them on the co-parent. Sometimes they'll try them on their boss or a co-worker. And we had one woman come back and report that she successfully negotiated her first raise from her boss when she wasn't ready yet to talk to her co-parent, but she was willing to practice in another arena.
That's great.
So we've seen huge shifts.
And I'd like to say also with the Safe Haven, many, many parents, I mean the majority, thank us for providing the services, although it doesn't necessarily help resolve the relationship with the other parent, it allows them to relax with their child so they know there's not going to be a conflict at that point of transition from one parent to the other. And that only has a positive benefit on the child because they know the child will have a safe transition.
A lot of people who have small children who get divorced eventually marry or team up with somebody else. Mm-hmm. I would think this would make their second relationship stronger too.
Potentially, very much so. And we've had that report from parents who have brought in their new partner, and that person has taken the class as well, that they've said that yes, this gives them a new kind of foundation, and now they recognize the value of articulating boundaries and expectations and negotiating outcomes in their ongoing relationship. And so yes, just like it might have saved some of those marriages, it creates a good strength and foundation for new relationships.
Now, your courses are available in English and Spanish?
At the present time, they're only available in person in English. One of our growth areas is to get a Spanish-speaking class. We do have a new online program for people who are not court-ordered. Court-ordered people normally have to come to the face-to-face classes because they need that kind of learning process. But for people who are not court-ordered, who do not speak fluent English, or are in another state, we have an online co-parenting class. And the online class, I believe, is available in multiple languages. And also in our online program, we have a facet called, that is a portal to a program, an online program called Our Family Wizard, which allows parents to work on their parenting plan, their calendar, the address book for all their children's providers. All of that can be coordinated online so that parents can work with all of that without even having to communicate directly with one another. So we have programs, and we're increasing our programs as quickly as we can to include in-person Spanish classes.
So the Safe Haven program is a free program, and the classes, there's a cost, but it's on a sliding scale, so it's really available to everybody in the community who wants or needs these services.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Now, of course, this has to be funded. And you are having a fundraiser coming up on Sunday, October 7th at 3 o'clock at the Lensic. What's happening?
Hillary Smith and her Soul Kitchen Band is giving a concert to benefit Children First and actually also the Friendship Club. We're doing a joint fundraiser for two not-for-profits. And
we
feel good about that because everyone feels they're always competing with everyone. And we're really excited about it because it's going to be, she's fabulous. She does kind of rhythm and blues and gets people up and dancing and moving. It's appropriate for all ages and family. She actually played up at St. John's and on the Plaza this summer, both places, to hugely great response. And a lot of people missed her because of the weather or whatever, were nervous. So we're very excited about it.
Excellent. And so that's on the 7th of October,
right.
And people can get their tickets just at the Lensic box office.
Right.
505-988-1234. And for more information, it's also ticketsantafe.org, I think.
Yeah, or you can also go to lensic.org.
Right.
It all leads you to the same place.
Mm-hmm. And for more information about Children First New Mexico, it's childrenfirstnm.org. And you can find out more there. Anything that any of you want to add before we go?
I would just also like to include our phone number, which is 505-473-7630. And while our main website where you can get a calendar of classes is childrenfirstnm.org, if people would like to explore our online options, that is childrenfirstusa.org. So either one of those sites will link to the other, and all the information is available there.
You know, the thing that is, to me, really exciting about Children First, among many things, is that it is an unusual program. This is not something that's available in every city in New Mexico. Max August had a very good idea. He was our founder and worked with Kat and others to create a wonderful curriculum and these workshops. And they are available. Santa Fe is very fortunate to have this kind of workshops. There are very few comparable programs in the United States. We hope to expand and build on this, and it seems to be going that way. But it is something that is really a treasure for Santa Fe and New Mexico, and hopefully it will expand into a broader market over the years. But it is unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I can't help but think of, as we discussed, all the different domains of a person's life in which these skills could be used, and Kathleen O'Wegan's modest goal of creating peace and harmony on Earth.
But certainly with the growth in the number of divorces and certainly the number of children who are born to never married parents, perhaps parents who never had a relationship of any meaningful sort prior to having a child together, these kinds of skills are becoming more and more necessary in the world that we live in.
Sarah Bennett is the president of Children First. Kathleen O'Wegan is a board member and mediator. She does the co-parenting classes. Ellen Biederman works with the Safe Haven program. And don't forget, Sunday, October 7th at 3 p.m. at the Lensic, Hillary Smith and Soul Kitchen, a benefit for Children First. Thank you all so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you.